Good morning. My name is Candace Moore, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Candace.
And thanks, Valerie, for inviting me to the committee. My gracious hostess, Aaliyah, I'm just quite outspoken, and she was so diplomatic. Candace is pushy, but, you know, I mean, it was cool. No, I got it. We were at dinner last night, what's your boyfriend's name?
Rick
was talking to an old-timer at our table, and the old-timer was just, you know, expressing some things, and I sensed controversy, so my ears perked up, you know, and I'm all leaning in and trying to be discreet. I'm trying to eat and keep the braces clean and pay, you know, get all in their business. It was just great, you know. Then I found a little window of opportunity and just jumped right in there. And so, so it was coming from both ends of the table. Yeah. And that's a good meal. I have had 2 hours sleep, and so I'm really hoping I just don't babble incoherently. Some nights I just can't sleep, and I said, this better not be one of them, and it was. And it was like close to 5:30 this morning when I fell asleep. And so when the alarm went off, it was just painful. But, the deal is I suit up and show up, and I'm here today because I don't want to die drunk. That's the deal. You know, 24 hours is a long time for an alcoholic. Ask someone who has the obsession to drink, and they'll tell you. It's a long time, you know, and Alcoholics Anonymous has given me so much, so much. I'm very active in this program, and everything I do is not even 1% of what it's given me. I have something in my eye right now, and it's so painful. I just thought, are you kidding? 2 hours sleep and something in the eye? You know what I mean? Is that detracting from my hair? You know? So the little situation Leah was referring to is that I missed my flight because I went to the wrong airport. It can happen, you know. And I went to the self-check-in, you know, and I go a lot of places. And so, I got it down, and they say 2 hours. I'm not giving it 2 hours. 40 minutes is good, you know, and so I go there and I'm doing the self-check-in, but I'm trying to find my photo ID so I don't read the little ticket that's printed out, which probably said, who are you and why are you here? You know, I just slap it up on the counter because I need this attendant to check my luggage, and she says, where are you going? And I tell her, and she says, when are you leaving? I said, at 12:30, could you check my luggage? And she said, are you leaving from here? And I said, what? And so, she said, we don't have any flights going to Maryland from here. And I thought, and I looked at my itinerary, and it said Long Beach, which is where I live, Long Beach, California. And I was in LAX. You know, we had rushed to get there. And so I asked her if she would call the other airport, and she said, why? And I said, because I got to go. You know what I mean? And, I'm going to tell you, I am not shy, and I am not always sweet and loving. And, you know, it isn't that that wasn't a good moment for me. It's that I was pressed for time, so she was so blessed. Like, the gods were shining on her. And anyways, I call my friend, and the funny thing is, earlier this year, I spoke at the International, and I missed my flight. So my friend goes, God's trying to tell you something. I said, well, I hope he texted to me or something, because I got to know. You know what I mean? I got to go. But in any event, I want to share three things with you, three of the most important things for me, a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the first is my sobriety date, August 16th, 1995. I have 10 continuous years of sobriety. And for an alcoholic, of my type, that time is an absolute eternity. When I came to you, I wasn't looking for anything continuous. When I came to you, I was tired. I was looking for a nap and a bite to eat. That's it. You know, when I came to you, I was 96 pounds, because when I drink, I enhance my drinking with things that keep me up for 8 and 9 days straight, and I like it like that. And let's say a nutritious meal for me was like a Snickers bar every 3 days, which produced the rapid weight decline. And when I came to you, I was missing my front tooth because I'm a mouthy little alcoholic. And apparently someone begged to differ with something I had to share. You know, and when I came to you, I didn't have a strand of hair on my head, because when I'm drinking, I enhance my drinking with things that produce a tweaking sensation. And so, I thought something was running around in there, and I like to envision myself as a problem solver. A friend had told me that rubbing alcohol will sterilize anything. And so I would drink and do my thing, and they would start doing their thing, and it was like some radical movement going on. And so, I sat them down, and I talked to them. I said, look, I know you're up there, okay? And you can stay up there, but I'm going to sterilize you. And so so I would start doing my thing, and they were doing their thing, and, you know, I got the rubbing alcohol, and I would pour it all over my head, and it was soothing, really. And then after a while, they became immune to it like a roach becomes immune to rape. And so I needed to take far drastic measures. I took the scissors, I cut off all my hair, I took a shaver and shaved it to the scalp. I would wear T-shirts on my head like they were fashionable turbans, you know, making my own statement. And that is the condition in which I was brought to you, and I am so grateful. All illusions, all delusions, and all facades have been stripped from me. The reason I stay in Alcoholics Anonymous is that by application of all 12 steps, all illusions, all delusions, and all facades continue to be stripped from me. It is what I need to stay here. The second thing I want to share with you is my home group. It is the Bellflower Big Book Group. It is a very active group in Alcoholics Anonymous. I come from strong sponsorship and people that respect the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the members of my group make sobriety an attraction for me. When I came to that group, there were people that were just buzzing with sobriety. And I need to see that, because when I came to you, you were asking me to give up everything that had got me here. You were asking me to give up everything that had kept me alive in those near misses. You know, and in order for you to ask me to surrender everything, you must give me a sufficient substitute. Alcoholics Anonymous is so much more than that. The third thing I want to share with you is my sponsor. His name is Clancy. He is sober a lot longer than I. As a matter of fact, tomorrow he will celebrate 47 years. You know, Clancy is not my sponsor because he goes all over the world. Clancy is my sponsor because he continues to demonstrate through his actions the results of taking all 12 steps and all 12 traditions. He is my sponsor because he is stronger than I. He continues to put Alcoholics Anonymous first. It is important for me to know that just because I get everything back, I don't get to just go out there and leave you in here. One of my favorite people is Kenna, and she says something I hope I never forget. She says, I hope Alcoholics Anonymous never gets in the way of the good life it has given me. You know, I hope I never become too busy to sit down and talk to another alcoholic or to take my seat on a regular basis in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I live in a world of people that are always wondering when I'm going to get mine, when I'm going to get mine, when I'm going to get mine. I got mine the day I got sober. Now I have a responsibility to give that back. That's the deal in order for me to stay here. You know, I want to share this with you. It's in Tradition 3, and when I got sober, I went through a recovery home, and it's always important I make clear the distinction that a recovery home is in no way affiliated with Alcoholics Anonymous. But what a recovery home did for me is it allowed me to get still long enough so that I could hear the message of Alcoholics Anonymous brought in by people that were participating on institution panels, of which I had three, and I still have them for over 9 years, people that shared when we would go to outside meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I remember I was like 40 or 50 days sober, and I loved being sober. It was painful because I had nothing to anesthetize all the stuff that I had done, and I'm living with what I had become. But it was beautiful because I was waking up in a clean bed, and I hadn't had to do the things I do out there as an alcoholic woman for, at that point, 50 days, and I loved it. And I remember we were in a Step in Tradition meeting, and I hadn't gotten into the steps yet. My sponsor elected to wait until I got into the sober living portion of the program, and, you know, they were reading from Tradition 3, and it talks about when AA was very new. And I remember that a fear seized my heart, and I'm just going to share it with you. It's on page 140 in the 12 and 12. It says, we were resolved to admit nobody to AA but that hypothetical class of people we termed pure alcoholics, except for their guzzling and the unfortunate results thereof, they could have no other complications. So beggars, tramps, asylum inmates, prisoners, queers, plain crackpots, and fallen women were definitely out. Yes, sir, we cater only to pure and respectable alcoholics. Any others would surely destroy us. Now, I don't know about you, but chances are, if I'm pure and respectable, I ain't an alcoholic. And, you know, and so now they're talking about beggar, tramp, queer, I'm 4 out of 5 right there. You know, so if all these things were in place, I would never have had an opportunity to come in AA and take my seat. But the deal is, if you hang in there with me, we go to the top of page 141, it says, could we then foresee that troublesome people were to become our principal teachers of patience and tolerance? Could any then imagine a society which would include every conceivable kind of character and cut across every barrier of race, creed, politics, and language with ease? Now they're talking about the AA, I know. They're just talking about the language of the heart. It doesn't matter where you work. It doesn't matter what your past is. It doesn't matter what your religious affiliation is, or if you have one. It doesn't matter what your sexual orientation or preferences are. We don't care. If you have a desire to not die drunk, we have a solution here in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you are new, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to share with you that you've been given the keys of the kingdom. But I also need to let you know that this is a program of action. It's not a program of whether or not I feel like it. You know, I don't drink near beer because I'm not near sober. You know? And you know, these things I share, you know, Aaliyah will attest, have so many things I just want to share. You know what I mean? It's important. I was talking to a friend of mine's sponsee, and she was 12 days sober. She's now like 5 months sober. But anyway, she was 12 days sober at the time, and we were talking about near beer. And she goes, well, I don't understand, like, what the big deal is. I mean, it only has, like, 0.2%, you know. And I said, sweetie, unless it has 0.00%, I can't drink it. You know, in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about entire abstinence. Entire means complete. If I am an alcoholic, I don't drink anything that has substance alcohol in it. Because although 2% may be, you know, barely anything to you, I never drank wine coolers because I just didn't consider that alcohol. It would be like flavored water. You know what I mean? So if you get to drink a wine cooler, why can't I drink? I mean, if you get to drink a near beer, why can't I drink a wine cooler? It's all the same. I don't want to start smearing the line. I don't drink anything that has alcohol in it. I define sobriety as not taking anything that affects me from the neck up, and that is for me. You know, when I was little, my grandmother raised me. My grandmother loved me. I know what it's like to be loved and made to feel so safe, so secure, so protected that absolutely nothing could harm me. I know what it's like to have that type of unconditional love because I've had it. I remember when I was little, I was afraid of the dark and I slept next to my grandmother. At night, I would watch her as she breathed. She would inhale, I would inhale. She would exhale, I would exhale, because if she died, I wanted to die with her. That's the depth of love I had for my grandmother. My mother is an alcoholic. She's an alcoholic by her own admission. She was young when she had me. She just wasn't done doing what it is she needed to do as an alcoholic woman. My mother is very well endowed. She believes in packing her pistol in her bosom. She's quirky like that, you know. And she would call my grandmother up and make some incessant demand. I always knew who was on the phone because my grandmother would grip the phone real tight and that little vein would pop out right in the center of her forehead. And my mother would say something, and she would look at the phone and say, absolutely not. There would go the phone. A short while later, my mom would pop over and just shoot out all the windows. Now, let's just say I was real clear I didn't want what she had. Okay. There are other cousins and uncles in my family that suffer from the disease of alcoholism. It is not why I'm an alcoholic. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous clearly explains to me that when I, not them, ingest alcohol into my system, it's going to set up a phenomenon of craving that will ensure I will do any and everything I have to in order to get another drink. That's the deal. You know, I'm going to tell you the way the disease of alcoholism manifests in my family is through a lot of violence. A lot of the members favored shooting. I favored stabbing. Tomato, tomato, really. You know. So it's safe to say that when we all got together, at some point, the police were going to be present, you know. And you know, I'm just going to share with you like a holiday in my, at my mom's house. My mom is a big girl, and she's a good cook. She cooks from scratch, you know, and I don't cook from scratch. I cook from the box. And the directions must be right under the light, and they must shine directly on the box. So that if it says a quarter cup, I must measure precisely a quarter cup, and if I go a hair over, I must pour it all out. I must begin again. That's how I cook. My mom doesn't cook like that. She does a pinch of this and a dab of that, and there's a fabulous creation. So if she's cooking, I got to go. Now, understand that when I go to my mom's house, she's drinking, I'm going to get a meal, but it may come with a little something extra. You know what I mean? And when you are little, you start to understand the signs of when it's time to go. And, you know, the way I understood what my cues were was by the music that was playing. I would go, it would be early afternoon, my mom was drinking, but things were looking bright. You know, the music was upbeat, it would be the Spinners, the Four Tops, it was good. As the book would say, not a cloud on the horizon. The day goes on, she's still drinking, the music changes, it's still upbeat, Diana Ross and the Supremes, not bad. Not bad. You know what I mean? Now it's early dusk. We're easing into Sam Cooke. Uh-oh. Okay? Because at this point, I want to go in the kitchen. I want to get the plate. I want to get the foil. I want to get ready. Okay? I'm like a sprinter. I'm getting in the position. Okay? She's still drinking. Now it's evening time, and she's in Billie Holiday. It's time to go. You know what I mean? By the time my mom got to Billie Holiday, she was... She had been drinking, now she's thinking, and now she's crying, and she's only going to cry for a minute, then she's going to get pissed off and want to fight. You know what I mean? And so it isn't that it was a good or bad thing, it's simply the way it was in my family. When I got into junior high, my friends were drinking and having a good time. I wanted to have a good time too. Very simple in the beginning. The thing is, what happens for me is when I start drinking, I don't care about you. Matter of fact, I don't care about you before I start drinking. Once I start drinking, I'm inclined to share with you that I don't care about you. You know, so please resist the urge to pull me to the side and tell me how I have wronged you, how I have imposed myself upon you, because really, I don't care. You know, and in the book it talks about how we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate seemingly without provocation. Not only am I mashing toes, but I'm wearing the highest of heels at all times. You know, and I remember my friends would come to me with tear-stained faces. They always want to tell you what you did the night before. Why? I didn't ask you. You know what I mean? I'm good. And, you know, so they want to talk to me and they get right up on me. And, you know, and so I would look at them very intent-like as if we were one. We weren't, because I wasn't even there. You know, and they would talk for 2 minutes to 20 minutes, it didn't matter. My response was always the same. I'd look at them, I'd pause for effect, and then I would say, well, that's unfortunate. It just didn't matter. It didn't matter what they had said. It didn't matter what I had done. That's unfortunate. That translates into, sweetie, I have so many toes to mash, really. The time is ticking. You know what I mean? I got to go. And I remember I was working at this department store, and it was a really nice department store. I was a teenager, and at that time in my life, I believed never work any place you can't shop. And so, you know, they will schedule you on the weekends when you're in retail. And normally, I'm okay with that. But this particular weekend, there was a beach party immediately equating into free booze. And so, you know, the writing's on the wall. I understood my calling. I got to call in sick, okay? But I can't just cold call. Oh, no. I got to get in a character, you know? And so as I go home, I'm standing in front of the mirror. I can feel the sickness descend upon me so that by the time I go to lift the receiver, I can barely hold it because I'm in a weakened condition, you know. And I'm waiting for my boss to get on the phone and, you know, so I can barely hold the receiver because it's got to be authentic, but my heart's pounding because I know I'm about to lie. And he got on the phone and I was all ready. And just as I began my tale, you know, he put me on hold. Oh, I was so insulted. Here I took the time for you. And the best you can do is to put me on hold? I don't think so. You know what I mean? And so I went off to the beach party, and when I look back over my drinking career, that sums it up. That's how I drank. I did what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it, and I didn't stop until I was done doing it. And if you hung out with me, you were going to do what I wanted you to do, or you were going to get gone. I am a team player. My team. You know what I mean? And so the following year, I was living with my godmother. She had purchased her Mercedes, And she had had her car for about 6 months. She did what any adult would do with their vehicle. She took her car, parked it in her driveway. She was leaving for a conference. She was going to be gone a week. So she parked her car in her driveway, took her keys, put them in the candy dish in her home. Only thing missing from that equation was me. And as luck would have it, I was going to a club that night. You know, what better way to go to a club than in a brand new Mercedes? Really, I know you're feeling me on this. And so I go upstairs, I call my friend, I say, we're taking a cab. I mean, we're taking the car. And that whole day was spent with Candace and Self, how Self would be featured, what Self would debut, how Self would be presented, you know. And as I'm driving the car, consumed with Self, I ran into someone else's car. Whoops, let me tell you something. My hat's off to the person that has a valid driver's license and insurance, because it wasn't happening for me. I made like I was going to do the appropriate thing, pull over, exchange information, but I just told you it wasn't my car. I didn't have any information to exchange, and I had a sneaking suspicion they were going to want to arrest me. Now, clearly, that wasn't going to work because I was going to the club. So, you know, at this point, the whole front end of the car had like a permanent grin, and so I drove it back into the driveway. I take the keys, I put them back in the candy dish, call my friend and said we were taking a cab. You know, we were going to the club no matter what. I also believed that when my godmother returned, she was going to be none too pleased about the car situation. She was, in fact, quite peeved. She had seen the movie Tough Love. I have never seen this movie. I don't desire to see this movie. But the effect it had on her was profound, I can assure you. After having seen the movie, she drew up a contract of things I was expected to do because I wrecked her car. And, you know, she was just really tense, like, way, you know. And she wanted me to do outrageous stuff like volunteer my time and give of myself to some charitable organization. And I thought, oh, what an order. I can't go through with it, you know. And, you know, she was just like, I mean, just her neck, her energy was so heavy, you know, and I just kept looking at her. She was going on and how she felt what I did was a vicious and malicious attack against her. And I thought, what? You know, and I looked at her and I was thinking, you have insurance. Why are you tripping? You know what I mean? And, you know, that is alcoholism in its purest form. It takes no account of my own actions. The only thing I'm not going to acknowledge that I have violated her trust, I've destroyed her personal property, I've disrespected her home. I'm not going to look at that. Matter of fact, I'm not going to look at that drunk or sober if I am untreated in Alcoholics Anonymous. The only time I even consider looking at my part is when I truly come to you desperate and out of answers. If you are here today, I hope you're hurting like hell. This program works better when you are in so much pain. The only thing you can do is just say, please tell me something to get this up off of me for 1 second. At that time, there was no pain going on. I thought she was making too big of a deal. I'm not living in column 4. I'm living in column 1. You're pissing me off. You know what I mean? And so I moved out because the situation was tense. And so, you know, the following year, I'm working in Beverly Hills, and I'm meeting different people, and they had given me an opportunity, this individual, to work for a record label. When I started off at the label, they hired me as a receptionist, but I like to think of myself as a visionary. Some say delusional. I say visionary. And, you know, so technically they hired me as a receptionist, but really I felt they were grooming me for CEO, you know, And so I walked around assuming that attitude, you know, like any moment they would be tapping me on the shoulder. It's so delusional. And so what happened is I started to get promoted. The more I got promoted, the more I got loaded. For several years, I worked in promotions, and I had an opportunity to work with a lot of artists on very successful projects. And, you know, when our artists would go platinum, you know, we threw a lot of parties, and a lot of things were given, and a lot of things were free, and I indulged in all of it. A member of my home group always says something that hits me to my core. She says, alcohol gave me the wings to fly, and then it took away the sky. Alcohol allowed all my dreams to come through. Anything I may have thought I could have possibly wanted, alcohol allowed to manifest itself in my life as a reality. I'm not here because I don't know what it's like to live your dreams. I'm here because alcohol had to dominate any and every action I took. You know, I will tell you that if you would have encountered me during those years of my life, you would have thought I was absolutely the most self-assured, confident individual you would ever come across. But I will tell you that inside I felt like a little kid playing dress-up. Inside I was always afraid that you were going to find out that my mom was an abusive parent who lived in South Central, and you were going to look at me and say, "You're not one of us. You don't belong here. Get out." All the time I walked around feeling like that. It did not matter that I would be dressed in Chanel from head to toe. I felt unworthy. That is alcoholism. It centers in lack, limitation, fear, not enough, not going to belong, not going to be welcomed. I am so very grateful that I've come to Alcoholics Anonymous and have had all of that torn out so that you could implant new information. It is vital. It is the only way I can stay here comfortable in my own skin. You know, and at that time, I remember finding out that my grandmother had passed, and when I tell you that she was my everything, she was it for me. My grandmother was the end-all, be-all for me. She instilled good values in me. She told me that I could achieve anything if I was willing to work for it. You know, and when I found out that she had died, I don't even recall having any emotion connected to that moment. When I look back over my drinking history, I don't recall having any emotion connected to anything because I was never present. I was always so preoccupied with getting loaded, staying loaded, how you could help piece up to keep me loaded, that I just wasn't there. You know, and I remember going home, and I don't know if it was a week to a month or a month to 3 months. I don't know what the time frame was. I just remember going home, looking at my stuff, and my stuff no longer being enough. And that was a frightening place for this alcoholic. My stuff represented my worth in society. It was very important, the label I worked for, very important, the artists on our roster, very important where I lived. If I opened my closet and the articles of clothing hanging in my closet were also featured in a magazine, I felt that is what made me equal to you. My friendships were not built on shared goals and common ambition. They were built on, "You're cute, I'm cute, we need to hang out. No depth and weight needed, don't even bring it up." You know, and I lived in a world of smoke and mirrors, talk so fast and dazzle them, they can't see what's really going on. It was not until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, so broken, so devastated, so shattered, in and through, that I have found it is an inside job. Money, property, and prestige will not keep me from wanting to put a gun to my head. If money, property, and prestige were enough, I wouldn't have come to you. I had it. I had a lifestyle that is absolutely a preferred way of living. It was very exclusive, and alcohol had to come first. You know, and I remember looking at my stuff and my stuff not doing it for me, and my disease started talking to me, and it told me that I was living and working in a world built on make-believe. It told me that I needed to get real. I don't know how to get real, but I know how to get loaded. In the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the doctor's opinion, it talks about why we drink. And the reason I always remember it is because it resonates in my spirit. It says that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. That the sensation is so elusive that although they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the truth from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. What that means for me is that every time I take a drink, the sensation it's producing is so superb, so magnificent, bar none, that even though every time I take a drink, I know it's going to cause me chaos, confusion, insanity, jail, always a bonus. Even though every time I take a drink, I know all this stuff is going to happen, I got to go for broke. I got to have it. Because the effect that is produced in me is unparalleled when I put alcohol into my system. And then it tells me that after a while, I don't know what's real from what's not. Why? Because I'm making decisions based on self. Something that may have been inconceivable or unthinkable a week prior is now par for the course. It's now just in a day's drink for me because I have found that this disease is progressive in nature. So I am, you know, at that time used to having a company take care of just anything I do and write off any indiscretions I've had. And now I'm on my own. I step out there and I have a habit and I have to, you know, I drink under all conditions. And I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous to stay sober under all conditions. I step out there and I make a decision to exchange myself for a drink. I step out there as an alcoholic woman. I do everything I have to do in order to get what I have to have. And it consisted of me compromising my dignity, my self-respect, my values every day, all day. I am under no illusion that if I stop doing what you've taught me to do here, that I will not walk back out there and do it all over again. As incomprehensible and distasteful as it is, I believe that once you've done something, it's just not a big deal to do it all over. Why? Because the shock value is worn off. This disease is so cunning and so tricky, so vicious, that it's going to tell me if you come at it like this and flip it like that, it'll be different this time. I have to be clear on the type of alcoholic I am. I like to get my drunk on. That's how I drink. I don't hang out with people that sip, don't like them, don't trust them. You know what I mean? And, so at this point, I'm out there and I'm doing my deal, and I've already told you that when I drink, I enhance my drinking with things that keep me up for 8 and 9 days straight, and I don't take care of myself. And, I remember losing a lot of weight, and let's say business started to decline. And so I went into a recovery home, not to get a brand new outlook on life, but to put on some weight, come out and make some money. You know, and I was there for 55 days, and I remember I hadn't lost a lot of my stuff. So I still had a lot of Chanel and Vitadini and Donna Karen. And so, and, you know, I was thin, but you pull the belt tight enough, it's that couture look, you know. And I would go in the meetings, and they were participation. They would say, does anyone want to share? My hand would shoot up, and I'd go running up to the podium, and I'd start spewing all this disease, and they would look at me, you know. And then I'd finish with a big flourish, and I'd go walking on down to my seat, and they would say, keep coming back. You know what I mean? And I was so delusional, I thought, they dig me. Yeah. I'm so grateful we're taught to be kind and loving in Alcoholics Anonymous, because anyone who heard me during that 55-day period, I know, thought, that is one sick little puppy. You know what I mean? But you never said that to me. What you did is instead, someone would write down their number and say, if you need a ride to a meeting, call me, I'll come pick you up. Someone else would pat the seat next to them and they say, I saved the seat for you, come sit here. Someone else would hug me after the meeting and say, you're looking good, how are you feeling? Alcoholics Anonymous was kind to me. I wasn't ready then, but when I was ready, I wasn't afraid to come to you because I remember they were kind to me there. I have a responsibility to be that for you when you come into Alcoholics Anonymous. It is not my place, if you have come for the first time or for the 40th time, to tell you that you should be done. It is, however, my responsibility as a sober member of this program to make sure my hand is outstretched to you each and every time you walk through the door. What I found through that experience is you are not done until you're done. You cannot hear until you can hear, and you cannot see until you can see. People around me thought I should have been done, but they don't understand that when alcohol is working in my life, I gotta have it. I gotta have it, period. You know, and so it was day 55, and I remember the women were talking about, you know, going to jail. I was like, ooh, can't relate. Let me assure you, day 56, that was quickly rectified. I sponsor women, and, you know, some of them, you know, their bottom was a night in jail. You know, they're all traumatic. They get, you know, real weepy. I got arrested. You know, and I'm like, for how long? For a night. I'm like, ooh, girl, a night wouldn't have been my bottom. It may have been a nap, but it wouldn't have been my bottom. You know what I mean? You know, but, you know, whatever, you know. I remember when I started going to jail, all my friends were there, you know, and I go in, I say, girl, I thought you were dead, you know, and, you know, you want to take a look at your life when you start going to jail and it's no longer a big deal, you know, because at that point it had become par for the course. My alcoholic life was becoming my only normal one. That's what was going on. So I was out there doing my deal, and, you know, I share with you, I don't take care of myself when I'm out there, and I became pregnant. Never would I do anything to jeopardize the life of an unborn child. Never. Ever. But I have also told you that I am not a periodic. I drink, period. When I found out I was pregnant, I made the decision to terminate that pregnancy. And I'm not going to share with you my personal views because they are an outside issue. I will share with you that I've been in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have heard people share from the podium that when they were little, they were left with individuals they should never have been left with. Things that should never have gone on happened. I would have been one of those types of parents. When I am out there, I don't do background checks. I'm just hanging out, and when I get the tap on my shoulder, the call of the wild, I gotta go. And if there's a little kid there, whomever is there is going to be babysitting. I could not guarantee the safety of my child because of how I was living. And for that reason, I made the decision to terminate that pregnancy. When I made that decision, I learned that a member of my family had been arrested for a child murder, and that person was my mom. There is going to come a time for everyone when your life is going to stop and it's going to stand still, and that time came for me. I remember when it happened, it was on every radio station, every news station, and every newspaper. And I just remember at that precise moment thinking the way I lived right then would be the way I would live forever. I had always believed once your destiny had been determined, absolutely nothing could ever be done to change it. It was not until I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous broken and devastated that I have found if you want what we have and you're willing to take these actions, your entire life can be reshaped. This is not a program of whether or not I feel like it. This is a program of action. I have a responsibility as a sober member of this program that when I'm up here, I talk about recovery from alcoholism. This is not Everything Anonymous. I don't get to because I don't like that fellowship coming here and start spewing a lot of different stuff. It is not okay. If I have only ever drank, I need to know sitting in my seat that I can recover. I don't ever want to feel like I need to have done X, Y, Z to qualify as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when I came to you, I was so shattered and I was so done. I am so grateful to the people that understood our traditions and singleness of purpose. They talked about drinking, the feelings that came with that, why they drank, and how they recovered. Because when I came to you, I thought, when they find out what's happened in my family, when they find out what I did out there, they're going to make me leave. You're not going to let me stay. But because you shared honestly, I knew that maybe, if I was willing to take these actions, maybe I could stay here. You know, and I went through that pregnancy as if I were not pregnant, and just doing everything out there as an alcoholic woman. And I remember going into labor. I was in labor for 17 hours. And when I gave birth to my daughter, Serenity, she was so beautiful. She was so beautiful. And I just cried because my heart broke. I couldn't believe something so beautiful could have been produced for me. And I remember I would hold her and she would shake. She kept shaking because she was detoxing. If you want to know what it's like to live in hell, it's when you want to be done and you are not. That is what living in hell is. When you want with everything in you, every fiber of your being to be done and you are not, you have got to see this through. You have got to get done. This program works better when you're done. That has been my experience, and I was not done. And I remember my daughter being 3 days old when I left the hospital, and I had to get done. I had to come to you surrendered. And it involved no dignity. It involved no self-respect, my journey to you. When I came to you, I already shared the condition in which I walked in here, and you were kind to me. You know, I would go to the meeting in the recovery home, and I was so tired, I would put my head down on the table, and people on H&I panels would come in, and they would share. And sometimes they would say something so deep, so profound, so life-changing, my head would shoot up. They would say things like, if you don't take a drink, you won't get drunk. What? Oh, my God. You know what I mean? I'm like, did you hear that? You know, and I thought, we got to write that down, lest I have to take a drink and get drunk, you know. Who knew, you know? So I started my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I remember when I was 4 months sober, I told the director that I had a daughter. I hadn't mentioned it to anyone. And, you know, because there had been a while since I had had her in the time that I got sober, close to 2 years. And she got all excited. She goes, you have a daughter? Oh, my God, where is she? We got to get her. We got to bring her here. I said, I don't know. So she gave me one number, and it led to a series of numbers. And what they told me is that in the eyes of the law, I was no longer considered her parent, that my parental rights had been terminated, and I was devastated. I can do anything when I'm drinking. I can rationalize and justify why and why I got to do it again. But when I'm sober and I have to sit in my own skin, I either have to take these steps or I have to end my life. For the type of alcoholic I am, there is no middle-of-the-road solution. I must surrender fully to you. And I remember I found out at like 10 o'clock in the morning, and, you know, all the shame and all the filth had come back, because for the 4 months I had started to feel good about who I am. You know, that recovery home taught me to be active and to get up and to do my chores and to earn my keep. And I would go to meetings, and you told me to help set up chairs. You know, you told me to get a commitment here, that this is my home and I must treat it as my home. I must take a commitment to help my home be presentable for you to come in, to make it inviting. I had started to feel good about myself, and then I found this out, and I just remember crying all day. And there were some of the women there who had children, and they had found out what happened, and, you know, and they were so loving to me. And it's just like when I have to look at what I did to defend my right to drink, the payoff just doesn't seem worth it. It just doesn't seem worth it. And I share that because I hear so many women come in with their kids. I'm coming in to get my kids back. You don't get everything back just because you get sober. So if that's your reservation, you may want to let it go. My daughter is 11 years old, and I have not seen her since she was 3 days old. But when she turns 18, if she ever wants to find me, I need to be sober. And sober for me is more than just not drinking. I need to have a life of integrity, of value, of virtue, of honesty. I can only have that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I take what you give me, and I go out there. I am at my best when I'm in the center of you. Everything I am, everything I breathe, is as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am not confused on that. You know, I remember when I was 5.5 years sober, I made amends to my mom, and I've taken all 12 steps. I continue to take them, and that was just one amends I just wasn't willing to do. You know, there's been so many things that have gone on at the hands of my mother. I would never share it from a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous, ever. And my sponsor did not push it. She said, when the time comes, you will know it. It will be all you can think about. And I said, the time will never come. I will never make amends to her, ever. And the time came, and I was 5.5 years sober. And I remember writing my mother, she's in prison, she's going to be in prison. And, you know, it is one thing to get in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and it gets so spiritual you just start levitating. Let us love you until you can love yourself. You know, it's an entirely different proposition when you must take these principles outside of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, when you must apply them to the people that have hurt you the most severe and the most devastating ways. I had to do that because I stand to drink. I have to love across the board. And I understand that there are people that are just going to be disturbed by this, and you just can't understand. I don't want to die drunk. My mother is an alcoholic. She's a very sick alcoholic. She has a mental illness. I believe we are all mentally ill to varying degrees. You know, and I have never talked to her about that case. It was one of the conditions of my amends. I don't get to tell her about her, and I don't get to ask her why she did what she did. There is never going to be anything that will explain it to me. I just try to be a good daughter to her. You know, and so my mother and I correspond, and sometimes I couldn't open her letters. I wouldn't be able to open them for months, and I would just throw them all out, and I'd have to start writing her again. And I share that to share with you that it hasn't been an easy reunification with her, because sometimes when I'm taking my cake, it's painful. I want my mom to be sitting there in the front row. I want her to hug me. And that I don't get that. It's just not in the cards. So what I do is I draw from different sources. I have members of Alcoholics Anonymous that are mother-like. You know what I mean? And they love me, and they hug me, and I get nurtured from that. And I am able to provide that to the women I sponsor. You've given that to me. I had gone through a period of not being able to write her, and I started writing her again, and she wrote me back, and she was talking about her chemotherapy, and I didn't understand, and I asked her what she meant, and she said that she had been diagnosed with lung cancer. And my heart just broke. It was so sad to think of a cancer eating her body and her dying behind prison walls. It didn't have to be that way. There, but for the grace of God, go I. It could have been me, but I came to you. it could have been me, but I came to you. You know, and I, I wrote her and I asked her if I could come see her. So at 10 years sober, because it was a month and a half ago, I went to see my mom for the first time since she's been in prison, for the first time in my sobriety. And I took my sister. I have a younger brother and a younger sister. My sister is the youngest. And my sister has suffered so much torture and abuse. We're not just talking physical. We're just talking like when you see people on the news and you think that's my mom and it just breaks your heart. And, you know, we went to see her and I just remember wanting to fall apart. But my sister was just so shattered and she was just sobbing and she would try to pull it together to talk to my mother. And I just understood that she needs me right now. I'll fall apart later. I'll fall apart when I get to you, but I need to be strong right now. And we went through that visit, and what I learned through that visit, because my mother had been writing me all these years that she's born again and she's ministering, and, you know, when they go to prison, they always get born again. But anywho, I thought, you know, I thought maybe, you know, maybe she might really, you know, and in that visit, I learned that she was not, you know, that her sickness has progressed, and she shared with me different things. And then she said she might be getting out in 2 years, and that wasn't okay because that visit had let me know that she's deteriorated even more, and I wouldn't feel safe. My sister wouldn't feel safe. My niece and nephew wouldn't be safe. And, you know, and so I left, and for 3 days after that visit, I just prayed she would die. And that you know, it's harsh, and I understand that, but I have to share with you honestly. Because I don't want someone, if you're new and you're thinking you're just going to get sober, it's just going to be okay. If someone tells you that, they're smoking weed. You know what I mean? It takes work to stay here. And I continuously do the work because I don't want to die drunk. The type of alcoholic woman I am, I would die violated in an alley. That's how I drink. I am clear on that. So I'd rather stay with you. You know, and what happened for me is that it was such a difficult period. I was so shattered from that visit that I just felt like I was losing my mind. I didn't want to drink, but I felt like I was going to go crazy. I didn't know what to do, and I didn't know how to get over this. And, you know, Clancy is my sponsor because he takes my calls at 11 o'clock at night. He picks up the phone. I need that because I thought I was going to die insane. And I continue to do what you've taught me to do in the bad times, just like I do when it's good. I stepped up my meetings. I stepped up working with the ladies I sponsor. And I remember going to my sponsor's home group, Wednesday Night Pacific Group, and I had left, and I was driving on the freeway, and I felt an anxiety attack start coming on. It was a week after I had seen my mom, and I knew that it was going to hit. I just didn't know when. I had flown out to speak in Atlanta like 4 days after that, and it was just such a hard trip. And this weekend for me, it's just been beautiful. The workshops, the speakers, meeting all of you, it's just been so wonderful. It was not like that for me a month ago. It was hard. I was in Atlanta for 5 days, and it was hard for me to come out of my room. It was hard for me to smile. I just didn't want to be there. Anna, I am so grateful to be an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm so grateful that you've taught me that I suit up and I show up no matter what. Because what I had to do then is what I've done this weekend. You know, I just talk to people. I just hang out. I see what's going on with their day. What workshop are we going to next? You know what I mean? And that's what I did then. But that night when I left the meeting, I started to call 3 people. I just started using all the tools you've given me, and it wasn't working. So I turned off my radio, and I was talking to my God, and I said, God, just help me get home. Just let me get home. Let me get home, and I'll fall apart. Just let me get there, because I'm on the freeway, and I have 45 minutes to drive. And I couldn't. I had no idea what to do. I couldn't see. I couldn't think. And so I had to pull my car over, and my sponsor is number 2 in my phone. And I hit number 2, and he answered the phone. It was 11 o'clock at night, and I was crying. I was sobbing. I could not talk. I was incoherent, and because he has been walking me through the situation, he was ready for that call. And he talked to me, and he says, I understand that when you are emotionally overwrought, that things become distorted and magnified. But it's going to be okay, and you're going to be okay. This is what I want you to do. My sponsor guided me step by step how to start my car, how to merge back into traffic, how to get home, what to do when I got home, to get on my knees, to go to my God, and to lay down. He said, it's going to be okay. It's going to look better in the morning. I didn't believe, but I believed that he believed, and that's why I got home that night. I was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard a speaker talk about his father. He talked about working with a newcomer, and the newcomer having to go see someone that was sick, and he took the newcomer to the hospital, and they prayed, and the newcomer was a big, burly guy, and when they started praying, the newcomer was squeezing his hand so tight, and as they prayed, he felt the presence of God, and the newcomer started relaxing his hand. And then he talked about his own dad being diagnosed with lung cancer and being able to show up for his dad and take care of him. And then he talked about his mother being diagnosed with cancer and being able to take care of her. And I was sitting in that meeting, and he spoke with such tenderness and such compassion that I started to think of my mother. And I started one more time to feel my heart healing. I started to feel the presence of God come in my spirit. And I started to understand that she's sick. She's doing the best that she can. And she needs you right now. Let it go. And I forgave her for everything one more time. And so the love and the compassion from my mom came back. It breaks my heart, but I understand. I just need to be a good daughter for her. And, you know, I remember just talking to God. Maybe God can heal her. Maybe he can come into her heart. There's two more years that she's supposed to be in there. My God is awesome. He can do anything. If he can come into my life and soften my heart, he can come into hers. All hope is not lost. You've given me so much here. Everything I am, everything I breathe is as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I want to share two things with you, and then I'm gonna release you. Because I certainly am going to be sleeping on the plane. You know, I have had spiritual experiences, and, you know, I remember when I was little, my grandmother would always bring home lemon meringue pie, and I loved lemon meringue pie. Maybe because it's the only pie she brought home. But I love lemon meringue pie. And so, anywho, I already told you I can't cook, and I couldn't cook then either. But my grandmother had, like, all these old cookbooks. And so I asked her, could I make lemon meringue pie? And she goes, yeah. So she, you know, got all the ingredients but a mixer. She didn't get a mixer. And I had never made one, so I didn't know I was going to need it. You know, and so I've made the filling and all that stuff. And, you know, I'm following the directions precisely. And then I get to the meringue part. Right, so I'm beating the egg whites with the fork, and I'm beating them, and I'm beating them, and it's like 20 minutes, and they're not getting fluffy like in the picture. And so I'm beating them, and I'm beating them. It's 40 minutes. I'm tired, right? And so, so I start improvising, deviating from the path, you know. And so I get cornstarch because it's got to be white, right? And so I get cornstarch, and I start putting it in the egg whites, and I'm beating them, and it's getting a little stiff, but not quite. So I get ice cream. You know, vanilla, and it's a little stiffer, but not quite. So I get sugar because it's got to be white. You know what I mean? And I'm putting, like, all this stuff in this meringue, and so finally I just give up, and it's, like, kind of meringue-ish. You know what I mean? And so in the morning we'd eaten and everything, and it was a little later in the afternoon, and she goes, where's the pie? I said, oh, no. And she said, no, let me see it. Give me a slice. I said, oh, no. You know, I love my grandmother. I'm not going to give her a slice of this pie. I'm not going to eat the pie, you know. And she said, no, it's okay. Give me a slice of the pie. And I thought, okay. You know, and I thought she was going to do what grandmothers do. You know, they take a bite and they say, it'll be better next time. You know, and I thought she was going to do that. And what she did is she ate the whole slice. She ate the whole slice of that pie. That is unconditional love. That's what that is. You know? And the only time I've ever experienced that is when I've come to you. Like, that's it. You know, I do the wrong thing. I put the wrong ingredients, and it's okay. You know, we're just going to, we'll make it together this time so it can come out all right. You know, one of the most beautiful spiritual experiences for me is to look in the eyes of one of the ladies I sponsor over the flickering flame of a one-year candle. having seen her come in this program broken and devastated from this disease. Watching her as she starts to apply the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in her life. Watching her as she starts to walk in her own sense of dignity and self-respect. Looking at her in her eye as she starts to blow out that one-year candle. That's a spiritual experience. This is a journey you must not miss. But if you want what we have, then I suggest you do what we do. Thank you for this weekend.